Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. Hope you've gotten through the crazy weather okay here in New York. We haven't seen this kind of chaos and destruction since perhaps 9/11. Brooklyn Battery Tunnel flooded for over a mile. Electricity out, all kinds of crazy stuff going on. I believe the casualty count is in the 40s. 80 homes burned, but you know, this is New York. We tend to get through these things, but on a human scale, those of us who got through it okay really have lots to be thankful for, and a reminder of how fragile life can be, unfortunately. And of course, we are now only about 4 days away from the election. Certainly another milestone for the United States, for our people. And so we have lots to talk about. I'm going to have Martin Seif join me in a few minutes, hopefully. But meanwhile, for those of you who are not familiar with me, I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So as you might imagine, my perspectives are in large measure formed by the issue of immigration, border security, and it's not a single issue. For those of you who think, gosh, how can we do a program based heavily on that issue, please realize that immigration impacts virtually every challenge, every threat that confronts America and Americans today. I spent 30 years with the old INS. I retired as a senior special agent assigned to the Drug Task Force. I've worked on terrorism investigations and narcotics cases and did all other jobs you might expect an immigration officer to do. But I've also been before Congress, testified before state legislatures, and provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. That's the thumbnail sketch. But if you want to read more about me, find out more about me, I have a couple of websites I would love for you to visit. My own personal website is michaelcutler.net, MichaelCutler, michaelcutler.net. I'm also happy to tell you that for years I have been a senior fellow with an organization out in Santa Barbara, California, beautiful part of the country, especially beautiful when you contrast their weather with what we had here with Hurricane Sandy. Their wonderful website is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. They've experienced the issue of immigration up close and in person, but of course part of the mythology is that we have four border states, when in point of fact we have 50 border states, but I don't think any state has suffered more dramatic impact than the state of California between the economic situation and so many other factors that go along with the failures to secure America's borders and enforce America's immigration laws. And finally, I have another website for you to visit called TalkBorder.com, T-A-L-K-B-O-R-D-E-R, TalkBorder.com. So there you have it, MichaelCutler.net, TalkBorder.com, and last but not least, CapsWeb.org. I have lots of friends out there. It's always wonderful to visit California, and great working with the folks at CAPS. There are so many issues that we are looking at today, and so many of them have a nexus to immigration. They just released the reports on unemployment. And what's so amazing is they're talking about, even though 171,000 jobs have been created as of today, unemployment has gone up a tick to 7.9%. Now, of course, it's amazing to talk about 7.9% and say, well, that's the number. Actually, I think that what's not in those numbers are the people who've given up looking for work, people who are underemployed, or people who are employed but working for far lower wages than they customarily earned. And in fact, the report has shown that the hourly wage across America has actually gone down a few cents per hour. It doesn't sound dramatic, but if you can't pay the bills or you're losing your home to foreclosure, it is dramatic. And it was interesting because I was just reading some reports over at CBS, and people were commenting on their website, trying to figure out how you could create 171,000 jobs and yet at the same time have the unemployment rate rise. You know, it seems counterintuitive to so many people, but in point of fact, what people don't seem to get is that the Washington Times just wrote a very interesting, or published a very interesting article, and the basis for that article was the idea that most of the jobs, two-thirds of the jobs, are not going to Americans or even long-term immigrants in the United States, but newly arrived immigrants. So when you look at it from that perspective, you say, well, wait a moment, how on earth can we do this? We have Americans out of work, and we're still bringing in more people to find employment in the United States of America. It does not make sense. Some time ago, I wrote an article where I compared the job situation to the game of musical chairs, and we all know how that game gets played. You know, a bunch of kids are listening to music, and they circle double rows of chairs where the chairs have each, you know, backs to each other. I'm sure you've played the game. When the music stops, the trick is to find a chair to sit in. The trick is, of course, that there's one fewer chair than the number of kids, so whoever remains standing is out of the game, and he or she takes a chair with him, and the music starts again, and it continues until only one child is seated. Well, the way we're doing jobs these days seems to be to simply open the door and let in lots more kids, or in this case, workers, but not bring along any more chairs or, in this case, jobs. And so when the president claimed that he was going to take care of the DREAM Act, what he wound up doing was precisely that. You know, Martin, I believe, is on the line. Let me go see if that, in fact, is Martin.
Yes, it is.
Martin Seif, how are you?
Very well, my old friend. Good to talk to you as always.
It's always wonderful to hear your voice. I wish you and everybody out there a happy Friday. I hope you got through the storm better than we did here in New York. I believe you're also on the East Coast.
Well, we are, but we're down in D.C., and the storm took aim at you guys. I mean, it hit Atlantic City, it moved north. We got off pretty easy down here.
Yeah, apparently so, although I heard Maryland had something on the order of 2 feet of snow. Is that about right?
Well, not the whole state. I mean, we're actually in Maryland, just outside D.C., and the snow certainly came, as you say, Mike, but that was out in the mountains to the west and to the north.
Well, it's kind of like real estate then, I guess. It's all about location, location, location.
Exactly, and if you're lucky one time, you may be unlucky the next.
Well, that's right, but don't jinx yourself, you know.
Oh, I don't want to do that, absolutely.
You know, I started out waiting for your arrival, and it's so great to have you with me on this call on my program this evening. And I was looking at the CBS News, and I was just listening to the report where they're talking about how 7.9% unemployment rate was the number, the magic number this Friday. But when you compare it to where it's been, it's inching up. But meanwhile, they're saying, well, they created 171,000 jobs. And in reading the comments from so many people, what was remarkable is nobody thought to talk about how many aliens, especially with the president's Dreamer program. He called it prosecutorial discretion, and, you know, I've called it prosecutorial deception, how the providing of illegal aliens with employment authorization and the continued influx, regardless of what Ms. Napolitano says, I believe we still have a serious problem with illegals entering the United States. So we have all these folks coming here looking for work. You know, economically, job-wise, I compare it to musical chairs or perhaps trying to run up a down escalator. I'd love your thoughts. But before you do that, why don't you tell my audience just a thumbnail sketch about who you are and what mischief you've been up to over the years.
Try and keep it short. I'm originally from Ireland, came over here around 30 years ago. Over the years, I was the chief foreign correspondent for the Washington Times and ran foreign coverage and was also at United Press International, UPI, was also the chief analyst for a decade. These days, I hang my shingle out of the Globalist magazine and I have regular columns. You can look up, your audience can look up on the Baltimore Post-Examiner, maybe political, focusing on the election.
Hot topic for this evening and for this coming week, don't you think?
Indeed. I mean, this one has so many butterfly effects, chaos theories, wild cards going in it. I think it's the most difficult to predict.
Even if you take Windex to your crystal ball, huh?
Oh, I was going to say, I think we need a 2.0 upgrade on the crystal ball on this one.
Well said. And by the way, it's an impressive background. I'm certainly honored and pleased to have you on the show with me today. So what's your analysis? Would you agree or disagree with what I just said about how we continue to have this influx of foreign workers, even as Americans are finding it difficult to maintain their standard of living? You know, one in six Americans now living below the poverty line, 1 in 4 American children living below the poverty line. It seems counterintuitive to go down this path, doesn't it?
But it does, but I think a major factor is, if you look at the history of the United States, I'll be tackling this subject to some degree in my next book, which is called Cycles of Change, which is a study of the political patterns of American history going back to the time of Jefferson, going on to President Obama, and whether the president is reelected or whether Governor Romney gets in next Tuesday. There is a pattern which goes back at least to the Civil War, which is this. In times of wide open migration, wages fall. Immigration, because that doesn't hurt so much when the country has protected tariffs to protect its growing industry. Though even then, conditions in industry in the 19th century, in heavy industry, were truly nightmarish, and they didn't get that much better until they were improved little bit by bit in the 1930s, but they were still lagging far behind working conditions in Britain, Germany, France, major European industrialized nations, all the way through to the time of the FDR and the New Deal. But the big change that comes isn't just unionization. Unionization only succeeds in organizing industrial workers and raising their standard of living when immigration falls. Immigration is cut off for 40 years in American history, from 1924 to 1965. And the irony is, it wasn't the Republicans who cut the throat of workers, it was the Democrats. It was the so-called idealistic liberals who passed the 1965 immigration reform, which we have had since, which has basically left, as you well know, Mike, our borders wide open since then. But as you also know, and as you and I have discussed on many occasions, people who talk about free trade in this country and call themselves conservative, well, they may be conservative with a small c, but they are not patriotic with a large p, because every country has to protect its borders. You're an expert, on, as we both well know, on protecting the physical borders of the United States and the need to protect the people of the United States from crime and chaos, especially on our current southern border, because the drug cartels are so strong in the northern Mexican states. But at the same time, we don't have our economic borders being policed, being defended, being monitored, being looked after. Other countries, mainly in Northeast Asia, have been swamping us with unfavorable terms of trade for the last 50 years.
And well, you know, it's interesting. I'm just going to cut you for a second. The point I wanted to make, what I've often said is that if you wanted to distill down the purpose for borders and immigration laws, you could distill it down to just 6 words, words that politicians from both sides of the aisle don't want to hear: protect American lives and protect Americans' jobs. That's why we're supposed to do this.
I think that's absolutely right. As you well know, I had a book that came out a few months ago this year, and it's
the book with
a
dreadful
title. Yes, I was saddled on me with a publisher I frankly refuse to use ever again. But the book has an important argument. It's called For Your Audience, That Still Should Be Us, which gives no hint of what the book is actually about. What the book is about is the importance of protectionism in economic history. For 800 years, throughout modern history and across the whole world, countries have protected their manufacturers and their businesses and their workers and their countries from for foreign competition prospered. And when they embraced free trade, their people became impoverished and the countries lost national power. And it always happened within 50 years. This pattern, rise and fall, happened in Venice, it happened in Spain, it happened in France, it happened in Germany, it happened in Britain, and now it's happening in the United States of America. And none of this is taught in any schools in America. True economic history is not taught anywhere. This is not conspiracy theory. It's not childish nonsense about, you know, aliens pulling the strings, or either Mormons or Jews or Catholics or the Pope pulling strings on that. It's got nothing to do with that. This is the straight economic record. Countries whose elites and populations are sensible and who have tariff protection on their borders develop very prosperous industries in their own countries, and then they can export them overseas. United States is very interesting in this respect, Mike. We preached free trade for 100 years but didn't practice it. And so we prospered. Our policy from Abraham Lincoln and General Grant all the way through to Dwight Eisenhower was to preach free trade for other countries to open up to American exports. And by and large, we through the strength of our arguments, we convinced them to do so. But we kept our own domestic industry very protected at the time. And that's why we were able to generate so many jobs, even under unfavorable terms until unionization was going.
I'm gonna tell you something. Now, we keep hearing the immigration system is broken, the laws are broken, the laws don't work. Let me read to you and the folks out there. By the way, for those who are joining me a little bit late, this is Michael Cutler, my guest Martin Seif, a noted journalist who's been out there all over the world, literally, for, it's got to be close to 40 years for you, is it not?
Frighteningly so, 35 to be exact. But you're
all right. Well, I've been at
close
it.
Enough.
I've been at it for 41. So there. That's because you're a child.
I was going to think about the combined experience we have between us, Mike. It's pretty scary.
I was just going to say it scares the hell out of me.
It might
scare the hell out of other people because they're afraid that they might actually get the information. It's the old Jack Nicholson line from A Few Good Men. It's not that you can't handle the truth. It's that our political leaders and the corporate heads don't want you to have the truth, and that's the reason for this program and the reason for Talk Border, which is my other website, and the fact that I work with the folks at CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization, at capsweb.org. But I want to read this segment from the law, and this is what the law says has to be followed before we permit aliens to legally immigrate to the United States and get green cards because they have a particular job. And here's what it says. Under Section 212A5A, and I don't want to get heavy in law because people glaze over, but it says, certain aliens may not obtain immigrant visas for entrance into the United States in order to engage in permanent employment unless the Secretary of Labor has first certified to the Secretary of State and to the Secretary of Homeland Security that, number one, there are not sufficient United States workers who are able, willing, qualified, and available at the time of application for a visa and admission into the United States, and that a place where the alien is to perform the work, and two, the employment of the alien will not adversely affect the wages and working conditions of United States workers similarly employed. So the law is very clear. We don't want you to come here if you're going to compete with Americans, displace Americans, hurt wages of Americans, and so forth. It's in the law. Alan Greenspan, and I think we've discussed this before, April 30th, 2009, went before the Senate Immigration Subcommittee, and I've been before the Senate Judiciary Committee, similar issues, talking about what they call comprehensive immigration reform. I've come to call it the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act, because it would enable millions of illegal aliens who, quote-unquote, are undocumented, can't prove who they are. We will tell them who they are, whoever they want to be, which means terrorists will be able to get new identities and embed themselves, attack us, and so forth, and it's about the jobs. But here's the interesting part. Alan Greenspan said, he was bemoaning the fact that we've now created, in his judgment, April 9, 2009, a privileged elite. And he wasn't talking about the CEOs of corporations. He was talking about Americans who have skills or education, and said that too much money was concentrated in that sector because of what he called wage premiums, and said that the solution to this collection of money among this privileged elite, what we would call the middle class, was to open up immigration quotas to subject American workers to international competition, to that pressure, because Greenspan's goal, and remember, folks, he testified at the behest of Chuck Schumer, who chairs that subcommittee in the Senate, the goal should be to eliminate or at least greatly reduce inequality in wages. Now, we all know inequality is a bad thing. If it's based on gender or race or religion or ethnicity, then I would agree. So he used those words because it's kind of interesting. You know, you hear the word, oh, we're going to fight inequality. But the inequality he was trying to eliminate was inequality based on education or skill level. Doesn't that boil your blood, Martin Seif?
It astonishes me, my friend, because, of course, this is a big lie on a scale that even the communists and the Nazis might have envied. A man who is from the heights of the real elite class of privilege in the United States is accusing the very people who he is shafting, whose families he is ruining for centuries, of being the elite. The criminal is accusing the victims.
Yes. Can you imagine? Imagine a rapist complaining that the sex wasn't good with the young lady he just ravaged and savaged.
Exactly.
And, you know, and when I heard it, I really wanted to put my fist through my laptop. And I'm sitting here and I'm saying, well, maybe I misunderstood him. But the interesting thing about congressional hearings, and I'm sure you know this, when I testify, when anyone testifies, you have to submit your prepared testimony in advance of the hearing, and they post it immediately. So as I'm watching this knucklehead, this crook, whatever you want to call them, up there saying these scurrilous things, I'm able to read the words. And I will tell you, I couldn't believe it. I said, now there's chutzpah. You know, the old Yiddish example of chutzpah is the kid that kills both parents and pleads for mercy because he's an orphan. That kid has nothing on Alan Greenspan.
Yes, or perhaps that kid was Alan Greenspan. I'm Alan Greenspan.
You know, but it was so astonishing to hear him say it. And I was on a radio station the next day, and my blood was still boiling. And the host of the show, a young lady, said to me, Mike, what did you think of Mr. Greenspan? What were you thinking when you saw him do that, say that? And I said, I was struck by the fact that I was probably witnessing a first. The first time I'd ever seen someone testify before a hearing while suffering from rigor mortis.
I don't think he was suffering from rigor mortis. I think he was very smart. I think he knew exactly what he was saying.
Oh, yes. But, I mean, the way he does it with that syrupy, monotonous voice that drones on like industrial equipment.
That's a very important point you just made. That's why people like that are able to get away so much with such outrageous things, because they do outrageous things, but they have a statesmanlike, boring, pompous, reassuring, predictable,
syrupy voice
tone. Exactly. That's a major reason for why they get away with so much.
And, you know, it is astonishing because you were talking about, you know, I'm registered as a Democrat. And I'm registered as a Democrat because, to me, blue-collar America are, for lack of a better term, the everyday American hero. My father was a construction worker. He was a plumber. He would go to work with a high fever. I literally carried him off his job at age 57 when he was dying of lung cancer. He worked with his last breath. I had to physically carry him off the day. Appropriately enough, it was a rainy day. It fit the somber mood. I was in tears. He was in tears. And his buddies on the construction site were in tears. Right after lunch, I helped him off the job. I literally had to help him get into the car. And you look at these guys who are out there busting their butts every single day. It could be 100 degrees out. It could be 0 degrees out. Their job is dangerous. It's filthy. It's backbreaking. And then we hear the elitists, the Alan Greenspans of the world, look down their nose at these hardworking, honest American heroes and talk about the work Americans won't do. And part of the reason they say it is because it's right in the law. You can only bring aliens in if they're doing jobs Americans won't do. So they twist the reality of it so they can say, see, we have to bring them here because if we don't, those lazy Americans, those stupid Americans, won't do those important jobs.
I will add in here again another plug for my book for a very specific reason, which
don't
you
go for
the book you know well. That is, That Still Should Be Us, and the reason I bring it up for the audience at this point is I have an entire chapter in that book devoted to this precise libel that Mike has just brought up. The myth that American workers are soft, are spoiled, are lazy, deserve to be outworked by Europeans and Germans and Chinese and Koreans. I am not anti-Chinese. I am not anti-German. Quite the contrary. I hold up in my book the national economic models of Germany and China to be admired, and Japan to be admired, not despised, because they generate prosperity for scores, in China's case, hundreds of millions of people. These are moral and sensible policies developed by governments with strong national consensus behind them. We had such policies in America for hundreds of years. Over the last 50 years, we have thrown them overboard. But one of the most disgusting lies is exactly what Mike has just said and documented, the lie that American workers are working less hard and they deserve to lose their jobs. Thomas Friedman of the New York Times is huge on this. It is an obscene lie. I argue in my book that Friedman ought to be outsourced. It would be very easy to do it. I know literally hundreds of very fine, utterly fluent in English, Chinese, and Indian journalists operating in Beijing, in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Delhi, in Mumbai, all of whom the New York Times could get to write for 1% of what they pay Thomas Friedman. The change would be that you would be reading original reporting and accurate reporting rather than old, endlessly stale, recycled cliches that were never even true in the first place. But this nonsense is destroying our country. It's destroyed our country.
And you know, it's remarkable.
We can't generate jobs. We cannot generate jobs because we do not protect our industry from unfair foreign competition. Romney says he will. Actually, if he were to do what he actually says, I would be impressed. But I don't believe that's going to happen. The president, in practice, has done some more sensible things, but where did the president get his jobs creation policy from? His staff were so lazy and mediocre, and I document this in my book, that they simply took a whole section on free trade from one of Thomas Friedman's recent books, and they simply stuck that in the presidential plan, which you now find on the White House website. They didn't even bother rewriting it. They just took a whole chunk of Friedman's book. He was happy for them to do it, and they attributed it to President Obama. And Obama was too sloppy to read it himself, and the Republicans are no better.
Well, but here's the point, though. Here's the point. What the president has also done, and I will tell you, I have had it with this administration. And I was very disappointed, by the way, when Paul Ryan debated Biden. I sent, by the way, a link. I don't know if you ever saw Jack Nicholson playing the Joker in Batman. But, gosh, it made me think of Biden with that incipient grin on his face constantly.
No, there I disagree with you. I think the vice president won that debate decisively.
Oh, he did. No argument. No, wait a moment. Wait a minute. Martin, I agree. He won. But here was a point that needed to be made about the failures of this administration to secure the border and stop this nonsense about, oh, the borders have never been more secure. And I can't get out of my head the words of President Obama standing in El Paso, Texas. I've been to El Paso, right across the river, right across the Rio Grande from Ciudad Juarez, arguably the most violent city in all of the Western Hemisphere. And
I agree.
My hotel room, when I stayed there, I was there consulting with a law firm as an expert witness in a criminal trial that was held in Hawaii. Amazing story. But my hotel room was on the top floor, just about 2 miles from the border, facing south. So I could see into Mexico for the week that I was there. And every night, you could see racing police cars running from one part of the area to the other, obviously responding to emergencies, probably mass killings, 50,000 people killed in Mexico since Felipe Calderon took office. And I look at this, and we're being told, well, the borders are secure, and President Obama stands in El Paso joking about how those of us that want alligators in the moat. Wow. You know, when they talked about Iran, and Paul Ryan was right on, he was spot on with the dangers I believe that we face from the potential that Iran will go nuclear, is the fact that Iran now has shock troops in growing numbers pre-positioned, if you will, in Venezuela, and there are terrorist training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil. Hamas, Hezbollah, which of course is a client of Iran, and likely Al-Qaeda. And he touched on it. He talked about that attempted assassination of the Saudi ambassador in Washington by an individual affiliated with the Quds, although he didn't really get into it. And these Quds, these shock troops, are coming every week in direct flights from Tehran to Caracas. And so our borders have never been more secure for reasons of national security as well as for reasons of economy. So that, to me, was a lost opportunity, Martin.
Well, I think you'd find, again, unfortunately, that Ryan simply didn't know the facts. I mean, the vice president was able to fill it in because Ryan's own plan does not make economic sense. I mean, when Ryan was talking about how it was the president who rejected the Bold-Simpson Commission, which had a very realistic plan to balance the budget, the president certainly was spineless and refused to push behind Bold-Simpson. He was basically sympathetic to it, but he didn't have the guts to go there, which a president needs. But the man who put a spear through the heart of the Bold-Simpson Commission plans to save the budget of the United States and our national debt was Paul Ryan himself, as he well knew. He told the Republican majority, and they went with him, Bold-Simpson does not cut Medicare and Medicaid, therefore we will not accept it. So everything he said about protecting Medicare and Medicaid and that the main threat to it came from the president is a lie, a straight lie.
Interesting. You know, there's a caller. Let me just see who's on the line. I'm just curious to see if you would like to do that.
Go ahead.
Hello, you're on the Michael Cutler Hour. Who's calling?
Hey, Michael, this is Neil. I was calling you from Alabama.
Hi, Neil. Thank you so much for the call.
Michael, this is just... you know, it is such a mess. It is hard to define in words. We keep thinking that somehow we will get someone who will help us fix this, you know, from an average American perspective. I mean, it has to make you wonder who really is running this country.
Well, you know, I think one of the problems that we face, and Martin, I want you to jump in, but let me just give you my hypothesis to start
sure.
with. I think the problem that we have is campaign finance. You know, I think we get the best government money can buy. The problem is that it costs gazillions of dollars to run for any elected office. We've gotten to a point that the money amounts are staggering, that these folks are pandering to people with the deep pockets. They know that most Americans are apathetic. Half of all Americans, if they vote at all, probably don't even know who they're voting for or understand how the system works, and our educational system isn't doing much to change that equation. And for these politicians, it's all about getting the money, getting the votes, and getting the position, which gives them power so they can gain more power, and it's, again, the power of the incumbency. Once they're in, for life, many of these politicians. Would you disagree, Marty?
No, I wish I could disagree with you, Mike. I really do. I wish I could argue forcefully, no, it's not that way, it's this way. Because then one of us might be right or wrong, and there might be a flimmer of hope. But I agree with you completely. And in answer to the best answer I can give your caller, who I thought, again, was very on the ball with this question. And I wish, sir, I had a happier, better answer for you is K Street runs the United States. K Street runs Congress.
The lobbyists.
The lobbyists on K Street run Congress. Everyone in Congress, everyone, Republican and Democrat, they're all up
And by the way, if you want to point, some of them are
quite simply too stupid to even realize they're up for sale. Who did the president appoint to create jobs and restore industry in America and create jobs? His top advisor on job competitiveness is Jeff Immelt, who was CEO of General Electric, the head of General Electric. This is a man who was proud of boosting GI stock values on Wall Street by exporting more than 100,000 high-tech American jobs to China, and they never came back. And this is who Barack Obama trusts. It's like putting Al Capone in charge of prohibition.
By the way, there's another component, too, and it's the Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
And let me tell you, the Chamber of Commerce, and I don't know if you follow the Chamber of Commerce at all, Neil, but they have created something known as the Discover America Partnership. So here's what they've done. They have connected with the hotel, hospitality, travel, and now the manufacturing associations and industries. They are demanding of the federal government, think about this one. I've testified before hearings where they've shown up. It was crazy. I've testified before state legislative hearings, for example, in Indiana, where they've shown up. They want to eliminate visa requirements, period. When I was in Indiana, a guy from the Chamber of Commerce stood up and said, I'm going to tell you something that nobody will have the guts to tell you, but I will, because I'm from the United States Chamber of Commerce, or actually the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. He said, America needs immigrants. Now, understand they use the term immigrant indiscriminately. It includes illegal aliens as well. He said, we need a limitless supply of immigrants with or without documents. We could care less, because that's how we're going to make money in America today. We don't care where they come from, but we want them to be here. Now, understand, Richard Reed is the reason we take our shoes off to get on an airplane, because he was going to blow up that airliner just a couple of weeks after 9/11 as the plane flew over the Atlantic Ocean to the United States.
Yeah.
Reed, however, as a British subject, did not need a visa. Massawi, the 20th hijacker, citizen of France, did not need a visa. So while we take our shoes off to get on airplanes because of the bomb threat, the fact that these knuckleheads could get on airplanes in the first place without needing a visa not only hasn't changed, but it's gotten worse. When Reed got on that airplane, 27 countries participated in the visa waiver program. Here we are 11 years after 9/11, and guess what? We are up to 36 countries now participating in the visa waiver program, in large measure because of pressure, extreme pressure, being applied by the Chamber of Commerce.
Well, this is kind of a roundhouse thing. We got so many of these seemingly disparate topics, but yet you find that every one of them has a connection.
Exactly.
For instance, I'd like to mention two things. First,
sure.
Is the I'm an independent now, so you know I don't.
Can you vote in the primary as an independent in Alabama?
Yes.
See, in New York you can't, and that's why I'm still registered as a Democrat, because I'll be damned if I'll give up my primary vote.
Well, I understand that. Well, there should be a place for the independents anyway, but that's another story.
Yes.
If ISA, the Republican, he has introduced legislation that's supposed to become active in March of 2013 concerning our patent processes. This legislation is an open sore to ruin our manufacturing capacity in this country, and for people just to literally rake us over the coals, it's going to destroy our country. Secondly, the Federal Reserve's charter is up for renewal in December. That's been in place for 99 years. They have been a thorn in our flesh from the beginning, and our legislators have prostituted themselves over the relationship with the Federal Reserve. And we need to do away with it and be on our own interest-free, debt-free money.
Wow. it's so funny that you're mentioning all this. But again, do you see the interconnection? And you know, you have Senator Gillibrand here in New York, and here she says, you know, she's got these commercials, and it really sounds great. Now most people look at this and have no idea what they're talking about. What she winds up saying is, we're going to stop outsourcing jobs. But meanwhile, she supports every effort to bring in as many foreign workers as possible. This is really the ins and outs of immigration and labor, isn't it?
If I could chime in here.
Sure, absolutely,
please.
Martin. Go for it.
You must be psychic, because I have an entire chapter in my book that's still to be up. And I think you've read this chapter, Mike, to confirm what I'm saying, on the destruction of patent law protection for American inventors. I condemn precisely the changes that you point out. And as you well know, these things are never discussed on the laughable so-called mainstream media in America. They are never seriously analyzed. mind. Even the so-called, what's the word, courageous reporters, the Bill Moyers and the Charlie Roses, never have either the brains or the guts or the backbone. They simply don't. They never tackle these subjects. But this is crucial. And I trace the start of the patent law. I don't know if you know this. You probably do. The patent law system that made America the greatest center for invention in the history of the world. It's all of history, was personally designed by Thomas Jefferson when he was Secretary of State more than 220 years ago in 1793. And although it's been tinkered with and amended over many years, sometimes negatively, usually harmlessly, very rarely positively, but that basic structure stayed in place until one man single-handedly demolished it. And that was Vice President Al Gore on his witless Make Governments Transparent and Open to the People reform. Because what Gore did was he insisted that the United States Patent Office put all details of every patent filed, even if they weren't given the resources to actually monitor them and approve them. As soon as they were filed, they have to go up there and have open access to the whole world because it's the Internet, and Al Gore is the genius who invented the Internet. And what did that mean? What has that meant? It has meant that Japan, South Korea, and China in particular, the Europeans too, but mainly China and Taiwan, are free to steal every invention that goes up there, and they have done so for the past 13 to 14 years.
Wow.
And when Bush and the Republicans were in charge, they were so simply stupid they did not even know that this was happening, and they never raised a finger to change it. And now the change that you have rightly pointed out, which will make things far worse, what's the great dream in America? Anyone can be Thomas Edison. Anyone can be Nikola Tesla. The Wright brothers invented flight. Who were they? They were bicycle makers. If they had gone through the farce of the supposedly technical and scientific education in Harvard and most of our bigger schools, they would never have invented that heavier-than-air flight. They would not have done it. They would have been told by more urban theorists it could not be done. They made bicycles. They made bicycles. And the world is now closed for people like this, because if you come up with something new, according to the change in the law, as you know, any big corporation can steal it from you, and you are forced to go into a massive legislative process, which no ordinary individual can afford, and any major corporation with deep pockets is designed to be able to beat out any individual. If I can mention here, you may not know this, Mike, this just happened last week. A friend pointed this out to me. I wasn't even looking for it. The family of Jerry Siegel have just lost their latest and almost certainly last legal battle with
Superman.
Time Warner's AOL
Superman,
exactly,
yes.
For the legal rights for Superman.
See, did I know or did I know?
Exactly. Jerry Siegel sold the rights to Superman to Harry Donenfeld and Jack Liebowitz, who ran National Periodical Publications, in 1938 for $130. Eventually, in the 1970s, under a much kinder, gentler regime at DC Comics, outrage at the destitution to which Siegel and Schuster had fallen was so great that DC Comics did very grudgingly give them a lifelong pension. And actually, two people who, to their credit, you can have people with souls in corporate structures, but you've got to look hard for them. The two heroes of this story were Jeanette Kahn, who was the publisher of DC Comics at the time, and her deputy for decades, Paul Levitz. And they made sure that Siegel and Schuster wanted for nothing. And by the time those guys died about 15 years later, separately, they were both living in California then, they were being given $100,000 a year each, which certainly is nothing compared to the billions of dollars Superman was making for Time Warner AOL. But the point is, they at least lived with their families in some comfort. But after Jerry Siegel died, his daughter Laura and her sons have tried to establish the genuine creator rights which their father deserved and which they deserved as his heirs. And they fought this case with Time Warner AOL for many years. But you can predict what the result was. They were rejected. They lost right down the line because money buys what passes for justice in America.
Well, you know, I've often thought.
And you can't fight it.
Well, I've often thought that maybe the time has come for us to have a national auctioneer. You know, I keep thinking of the Mecum Auto Auction. And instead of bidding to the highest bidder where labor is concerned, it's going to the lowest bidder now. We have a race to the bottom. And I have to interject one point. It seems tonight that every time I've mentioned something, you've told me about your book. So you're reminding me of my of Apple computers when they say we have an app for that.
Actually,
I just couldn't resist.
Well, I'm hoping to have one out for these things in a few weeks' time. It isn't legal problems there. It's simply when you do things with your wife and on a shoestring, you know you're never going to make it big, and you get things out in the end into the marketplace. But you're lucky if you have a communications footprint the size of a flea, and I'm under no illusions about that. And here is this vast nation of ours, the North American continent, 310 million people from coast to coast. And I'll tell you, I saw more independence of thought covering the crack-up of the Soviet Union during the Glasnost era under Gorbachev from 86 to 91. You were allowed to say on national television then, of course you weren't before, they would have shot you with millions of other people if you'd done it for 70 years before. But when the system was collapsing, you could say on national Russian television, the system sucks, we have to change it. You cannot see that on CBS or CNN or Fox or Uncle Tom Cobb, you know.
Well, you know,
cannot
I have
say
to tell
that
you.
At all.
I'm going to stop you for a second, and then I want to hear what Neil has to say, and I appreciate the call, Neil. You know, I've been on TV probably 300 times to talk about immigration, but the push for globalism is so strong that nobody at this point really wants an honest conversation. And they have relegated immigration, if you think about this. Oh, it's a single issue. No one's going to talk about it. And then there's something else that they do, and I really want to touch on this because Election Day is, you know, we're breathing down the barrel of Election Day. And we hear about this mythical Latino vote. And, you know, I was a federal agent for 30 years. And if you even raise the specter of profiling, they want you drawn and quartered. The same journalists that scream about profiling in law enforcement are the same pompous fools that get before the cameras. And what do they talk about? The Latino vote. And when I travel around the country and do speaking events, I say, wait a moment. Why on earth would any American citizen, Latino, black, white, purple, polka dot, why would any American want the laws that are supposed to protect American lives and American jobs be ignored? And in fact, it's the ethnic immigrant communities, not just the Latino community, the Russian community, the Asian community, the Haitian community, the Caribbean community. They're all getting hammered because when we let the criminals in, and you know, the aliens who've run the border are more likely to be criminals than within the general population. That's why 30% of the federal inmate population are in fact illegal aliens. And when we let the criminals in, they're coming from other countries. They settle. They do business. Generally, within the ethnic immigrant communities, they're the ones who recruit the kids into the gangs. The people that live there are the most likely to be forced into doing things they don't want to do under the fear of having their families harmed back home, whether it's prostitution or become couriers or whatever. I know. I saw it firsthand as an agent. So they're losing the jobs to these people. The unemployment rate among America's minorities are way higher than it is for the rest of the population. The violence factor in the immigrant community is through the roof. And meanwhile, we hear this mythology and these cowardly politicians who can only think about votes. What do I need to do? What do I need to do? Hear this. And I think what's happening is they're being swayed to make god-awful decisions for fear of a voting bloc that doesn't exist. Because wherever I go, Latinos come up to me and say to me, Mr. Cutler, you're completely right. Why on earth does anyone think that this is what I want to see happen in America?
If I may chime in there, Mike, again,
sure.
Not disagree at all, but on the contrary, it's such a relief to hear you say this. And as Neil rightly said, when you and I, and Neil too, we all at first seem to be asking different questions or bringing up different points, but everything interacts with everything else, and it all comes back to the same wavelength. Throughout American history, going back at least 170 years to when the Irish came over from my native Ireland in great waves, fleeing the great famine of 1845 to 1848, there is a pattern which continues to this day, and it's exactly what you said, and that is is millions of people come wanting to make a better life for themselves and their children, but when the criminals come in, the first people are always the people who they take advantage of the most, the people who they mercilessly exploit and terrorize and steal from in the most terrible ways, who they reduce to prostitution, are not white Americans or Protestant Americans or this or that. The Irish mobs in the 19th century in Five Points of New York, the Italian and Jewish run mafioso in the 1920s and 1930s, they preyed most of, or terrorized their own. Jamaican drug gangs did it. Chinese Hongs did it. Vietnamese drug gangs do it in Virginia to this day, as you well know. It is always the honorable law-abiding vast majority that wants and needs law and order and welcomes it on the rare occasions, unfortunately today, when the federal and state governments provide it. There is a moral duty here to protect people in the ethnic communities from evils within those communities. Most people are law-abiding. Most people want to be loyal, God-fearing American citizens.
And by the way, we let in 1.1 million lawful immigrants every year. They're the ones most at risk. And I just got an email just before showtime from Mark Hager. I was just with him. He's a professor of history in North Carolina. We have a film coming out, Invasion, Freedom Under Fire 2. And here's the article out of North Carolina. Guess who's out campaigning for Mr. Obama? Illegal aliens going into the immigrant communities to try to convince American immigrants, citizens, that they need to vote for this administration.
Michael.
Well, I will
Go ahead, Neil. Let's let Neil get a word in. I'm sorry, Neil.
Sure.
No, that's fine. Michael and Martin, I don't want to stray from your current topic because you're both accurate about that. But this is something that's been bothering me for a while now. We got a president is walking around with his chest all puffed out over finding one person, Osama bin Laden, the only cause for us going into Iraq, if you can believe that, but in this country, every day, we have 2,100 kids go missing, and they recover about 35 to 40% of them, but the rest of them are not popping up around the world. They're not coming up inside this country. We don't know what happens to them. So just during Obama's administration, not counting Bush's administration, we got 1.5 million kids missing over 3 years. Where are they?
Well, it's the first I've heard of those numbers.
Department of Justice numbers.
No, I'm not doubting you, Neil. It's something that wasn't on my radar scope. Look, there is so much that's happening that's not being dealt with by law enforcement.
Exactly.
Not the way it should be. You know, one of the mythologies we hear about immigration, by the way, is if we enforced immigration laws, then we would lose the ability to do community policing, which is a bald-faced lie. I spent half my career working intimately with the NYPD, and one of my responsibilities was to cultivate cooperators and informants. And you cannot find a better example of community policing than to develop people within the community who are willing to come forward. It is lie after lie after lie. And you touched about bin Laden, and I have to say something, because this is something I wanted to raise today, and I'm not trying to gloss over your point, but it just goes back to what we're not doing, and it's all about statistics. You know, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. But I think that if you look at Benghazi, I have a suspicion, and I wanted Martin to weigh in. And we can go a little bit long because we do have a little extra time on this, and if you want to, we can do that. But because Benghazi is so important, because here we had an American ambassador and three State Department officials slaughtered, a general who wanted to go to their aid, removed a command. I don't think it was coincidental. In law enforcement, we say if you see a coincidence, you better look again. And my hunch, and Martin, I certainly want your opinion, you're the world traveler here, and you're the journalist, but it seems as though just before this happened, we kept hearing bin Laden's dead, GM's working, all's right with the world, as though we've solved the world on terrorism and everything else. And suddenly they had to concede, no, the terrorist threat is alive, well, and growing, And so I think that that may have figured very prominently into why they did not, under any circumstances, want to admit that it was a terrorist attack. And then ultimately, of course, what do? And I'm no huge fan of Hillary Clinton, but they threw her under the bus over this deal. Martin, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Actually, I have a very different view. I think Hillary Clinton got away shamelessly with this. Secretary Clinton is a very skilled politician, but
absolutely,
there's a pattern to her. But there's a pattern to her career. She cannot. People who called her a hard leftist miss the point entirely. She's quite to the left, but like the president, she's no wild radical. Like the president, she's very typical in her views of the mainstream Democratic Party. They don't think about anything, and they think in cliches. The Republicans, I would say, are exactly the same. But the key point with Hillary Clinton is she cannot administer to save her life, and we have seen this repeatedly. If you put her as First Lady or in the Senate or just to make speeches as Secretary of State, she looks superficially impressive or at least passable, and all the useful idiots who will simply want any woman, regardless of whether she's a genius like Margaret Thatcher or an absolute idiot, they don't care. They just want somebody up there to say, you know, abortion on demand and women's rights and what have you. And Hillary passes that line, but she cannot administer to save her life. The President Bill Clinton, her husband, put her in charge of health care reform in 1994, and it was a fiasco.
They yes, it was.
Took track of meetings. They didn't even keep minutes of the meetings. They let people wander in and out. It collapsed. It was a laughing stock. It was such a mess that Clinton lost control of the House
right,
of the Democrats.
So here's my question, though, to get back on the target.
On this business, she messed it up.
Okay, but now here's my question. Let's put Hillary aside for the moment.
She should have resigned. She says she was responsible. If she was responsible and the warnings were there and the warnings have been documented, was there. Now, of course, the president didn't want her to resign, and she certainly didn't want to resign. And it's the height of the election campaign. But having said that, I don't think this is a huge smoking gun. For the simple reason that the Republicans got away with something far larger. They were taken totally by surprise on 9/11, when nearly 3,000 Americans were killed. And 24 hours before that happened, the day before it happened, a group of United States senators from both parties went to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and said, we want to take $500 million, we want to take $500 million, a very modest sum in U.S. budgetary terms, out of the defense budget for anti-ballistic missile defense, and we want to put it on border security, and we want to put it on a protection against groups specifically named Al-Qaeda as one of the groups. This was 24 hours before 9/11, the Monday. And Rumsfeld said, if you do that, I will recommend President Bush to exercise his first veto in the White House and to scrap the entire defense appropriations bill. We are not giving a cent for this. It isn't necessary. You're being ridiculous. And Rumsfeld is a very arrogant, as well as being a very stupid man. And he made sure his contempt for the senators was well known. And this was buried right afterwards. This was buried. So was there a mess up here? Of course there was.
But here's my question. Martin, wait one second. But here's my question. Do you believe that I think it's pretty clear now that they knew it was a terrorist attack. Do you think that it was because it went against the narrative that they were trying to skillfully create for campaign purposes? And then I'm going to make a point about what you just said about the borders. But go ahead. I want to get just a narrow answer from you on that one, just for starters.
I haven't been following it closely enough on that, but from what I've seen, I think, yes, they did want to craft the narrative. But there were two other aspects. There was one man in the administration who was relatively honest on the issue, and it came up in the presidential debate, and within 24 hours he said quite casually and loosely, of course it was a terrorist attack. Who was that man? It was the president himself, President Obama. The person who messed it up, who derailed her boss Hillary Clinton, was Susan Rice, the ambassador to the United Nations, who, if the president gets in, may well be is a front runner for Secretary of State. Heaven help us. And I say that because this lady is a walking disaster area wherever she goes. When she was Assistant Secretary of State for Africa in the first Clinton administration, she did not realize the danger of genocide in Rwanda, even though the warnings were being yelled in her ears, and she was more responsible than any other individual for the failure of the United States to act decisively and deter that genocide, which we could easily have done with our allies. It could easily have been done. Most things are very hard to do. You risk wars with Russia or China, and that's not worth risking. But this thing that the Russians and the Chinese weren't involved. But it's the same Susan Rice who throws the administration into the position, this wasn't a terrorist attack.
Well, but yet, wait one second. We'll go a little bit long. We have up to 30 minutes extra time. We have bumper time built in. But here's my question, Martin, though. The president may have said it where people thought that was what they heard. I didn't hear him admitting that this was a terrorist attack until a week later. But let's move away from that for one moment. You've raised the issue about what happened the day before the attack. What you may not know is before that, I had been in touch because, I testified before Congress back in May of 1997, May 20th, about visa fraud, benefit fraud, because they were specifically looking at the first two terrorist attacks on our soil committed in 1993. January 93, as you may recall, a guy by the name of Amir Kansi, a Pakistani national who got political asylum by lying, repaid America for its incompetence in giving him political asylum by standing outside CIA headquarters with an AK-47. He opened fire, killed two CIA officers, wounded three others, fled the country. You know, transnational criminals and international terrorists have that escape hatch. They leave America and they go home. In his case, though, we hunted him down like the dog that he was. We brought him back, put him on trial, found him guilty, and executed him. But, of course, the people he killed remain dead. The people that were injured remain injured. And then 1 month later, we have the first attack at the Trade Center. And, in fact, these were all aliens who had gotten to be able to stay in the United States, either by committing visa fraud or they lied on applications for amnesty. And that's why I came to call Comprehensive Reform the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. Because a guy by the name of Mahmoud Abu Alima, one of the terrorists of the 93 attack when they did what they did to the Trade Center, had been given amnesty allegedly as an agricultural worker in the Reagan 86 amnesty, when in point of fact he was a cab driver and the only thing he ever planted was a bomb in the garage of the World Trade Center. And in fact, around 1999, I had conversations with the then chairman of the Immigration Subcommittee, he now chairs the House Judiciary Committee, Lamar Smith, and his chief counsel, because I had recommended that they remove the immigration benefits program from the rest of immigration and create what I call the enforcement tripod. And I said, look, the Border Patrol is supposed to protect America and enforce the immigration laws between ports of entry. The inspectors enforce the law at ports of entry, and then you need an interior enforcement program that backs up the other two operations, and all three legs should be of approximately equal length. Well, we hear a lot about the border. You never hear about interior enforcement. You never hear about the fact that we give out citizenship to people, and I do mean give it out, without any knowledge as to who in blazes we're giving it to. In fact, in 2006, the Washington Post ran an article that went into a GAO report that claimed that Citizenship and Immigration Services claimed to have lost, catch this guys, 111,000 immigration files relating to various applications,
yes,
including 30,000 people we naturalized without their files. I mean, it's astonishing. 5 years after 9/11. So you look at this disaster. In fact, I had recommended they refer to INS with a new name, and they actually had an event in the well of the House. I was contacted by Jim Sensenbrenner, who at the time chaired the House Judiciary Committee. They said, watch C-SPAN tomorrow. They held up a banner with the name of this new agency that I wanted to see created, and it was Bureau of Immigration Enforcement, BIE.
Yeah.
And along came DHS, which I now call the Department of Homeland Surrender. And they have taken the immigration mission under this administration and the prior administration, George Bush as well, and shredded it. Most of the people running immigration came from customs, and now you have an administration that says if you're here illegally, we don't care how you get here, as long as you have no convictions for felonies, we're happy to put you on a path to citizenship or at the very least give you employment authorization. I wrote a commentary. In fact, there's a commentary I hope that the Fox News Latino will be publishing over the weekend that I just wrote. And basically what I've said is that by doing this, President Obama fired the starter's pistol for aspiring illegal aliens across this planet, and for them, the finish line is the border of the United States of America.
It sounds almost like a Project Paperclip all over again, only supercharged.
Well, it is, and what it also is what Bill Clinton did. That's why Clinton doesn't get a pass. Because after those two terrorist attacks in 93, I remember sitting down with a bunch of my friends at ATF, the FBI, DEA, cops, and so forth, who were all working with the drug task force. I was over with what was known as OSINT, the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. We all believed that this was that watershed moment when finally immigration would come to the fore. And instead, President Clinton and put Al Gore, our hero, here's Al Gore again, in charge of something known as CUSA, Citizenship USA. And they ran over a million citizenship applications through this bureaucratic goose, and it came out like crap. And it turned out afterwards the GAO came in and said, you know something? Not only shouldn't all of these people have been naturalized, but some of them were criminals who should have been deported. And they did nothing to address the vulnerabilities that were exposed when they looked at how the terrorists who committed those attacks in 1993 managed to get into the United States and then, in the parlance of the 9/11 Commission, to which I provided testimony, embed themselves. I call it hiding in plain sight.
Well,
Al Gore again, and Bill Clinton.
Well, Michael,
yes.
We're looking at our representatives. You know, we just keep looking to them to help. And there's no help. There's no help coming from either side. It's just like if you look at the legislation that is passed every time we change presidents, all the way, I mean, it goes way back. The American citizen is losing every – we think we're supposed to be progressing here, but we're not progressing.
We're regressing.
Yes. We're coming apart at the seams. It's almost like it's designed to happen. I mean, how can they ignore these events and not do something about them?
Well, I want you to know what part of the problem is, because I think I'm up to 15 congressional hearings now. And let me tell you, when you go to Washington, if you want to talk about a puzzle palace, I tell you, it's built on the right real estate, though. It's landfill and swampland, and that couldn't be more appropriate. But you have politicians who I think some of them really mean well, but they are being guided and advised in many cases by kids who are under 30, who went to the Ivy League schools and are drinking the Kool-Aid, not with one straw, but two straws. So
if
they
I may
hear...
chime in here.
Go ahead, Marty.
Thank you. And again, not to disagree. Again, I wish I could. But only have you hit the nail
Which
on
chapter
the head.
Is it in? Come on, Martin.
No, actually, I can't remember. I may even have it in there. But here is where it changed. One man who was the epitome of corruption in American history was responsible for this change. Until the 1950s, congressmen and senators had very small staffs. They couldn't afford to have big staffs. So they actually had to do hard work. They had to be smart to avoid making fools of themselves. They had to be on top of their subjects. And what you found, especially in the Senate, was a very effective informal system developed. There would be half a dozen senators who would specialize in Social Security. There would be a dozen who would work closely with big business to protect American business and maintain tariffs. There are others like Sam Nunn, who was one of the last of the line, or Richard Lugar, who were specialists in nuclear and strategic issues. One of the last of them, and he was very good in his own area, was Senator Dan Quayle, who became a laughing stock as vice president. But I had the privilege to talk privately a number of times with Senator and then Vice President Quayle, and I was very impressed with his grasp of strategic issues. And that's even then, 20 years ago, that was extremely rare in Washington. Where did the system change? It changed in the 1950s when Lyndon Baines Johnson was Senate Majority Leader, and he pushed through a new system whereby, since America was so wealthy and the Senate and the House were so important, every senator and congressman could have unlimited staffs with hundreds of people paid for at the public expense. And this transformed everything, because every senator and congressman's office was then transformed into an oriental court of intrigue. as every senator and congressman could devote all their time to simply raising more and more money for campaigns to be perpetually reelected, which almost all of them are. And this was when the arrogant little jerks who know nothing and curl ass came in. And as a result, over the past 50 years, a permanent, arrogant government elite of precisely these kids that you mentioned, and you are absolutely right, and they are so arrogant. Look, I've had the privilege to meet a couple of Hollywood movie stars, and there are several that we really rewrite this in the tabloids, but I won't, you know, embarrass them by naming, who are unpleasant people. But a surprising number of them are very pleasant people. And one of the most impressive I ever met as a human being is George Clooney, who's a liberal Democrat, and he's a very fine man. And when he meets people who are strangers, he is gracious, he gives them the time of day, and when you have a chance to meet with him or see him in action in private, you realize this is not an act. He really is a nice guy, right? And there are many others, like Bruce Willis, who have this reputation too. Some are liberal, some are conservative. My point is this.
By the way, I have to chime in and tell you,
Hollywood produces is vastly superior to the character that Wall Street produces, but most of all, vastly superior to the character that the Washington political culture produces. What the Washington political culture produces is arrogant, ignorant, lazy, incompetent gutter snipes and parasites who are specialize above all else in slandering and libeling innocent people and having contempt for the vast majority of Americans.
Well, that's the point. First, you're giving parasites a bad name there.
And I will only add here, the Tea Party had theoretically a very good idea, which is term limits. What could be simpler? And yet, who do they now embrace and love and revere? Congressman Ryan. Paul Ryan at 41 has never had a job in his life. He was a congressional aide. He licked his way up to have a chance for a safe congressional seat in Wisconsin. He got that seat. He has now been reelected to that seat 7 times, and he is making sure that if he loses this race, he's still got a $2 million fund to reelect him automatically into his Wisconsin seat, so that even if he loses next Tuesday,
Listen. If you had a seat in Congress and if your state allowed you to make certain that you had that reserve parachute, I think anybody would do it. Wait a moment,
Mark. Democrat. You wouldn't let him do it. This is contemptible behavior. He's a hypocrite.
Hold on a second.
People are idiots. This is their hero.
Hold on a moment. I've met with enough Tea Partiers to tell you that they aren't monolithic either, okay? There are some that I met. I spoke at the Tea Party event on July 4th at the South Fork Ranch a couple of years ago. It was a sweltering day. It was awful. I was amazed that we had about 20,000 people in the audience when I spoke. And afterwards, when I walked through the crowd, I found quite a few Democrats who had become disenfranchised with the Democratic Party. The Tea Party, I can tell you, from having met with them, I'm going to be in South Carolina, Myrtle Beach, this January with the Tea Party. There's a lot of diversity in their philosophies and in their backgrounds. Let's be fair about that, number one. They're not organized, and that's a point they always like to make. Number two, I may agree or disagree with you about Ryan, but I think if you were in elected office, in being fair about this, people want to protect their jobs. We all engage in whatever we can do to have job security. And he said, okay, the law permits me to do this. I'll be honest with you. I think most people would avail themselves an opportunity to make certain that they don't wind up on the unemployment line.
Oh, Paul Ryan on the unemployment line. Don't give me that.
No. Look, he could go elsewhere, but I think he wants to stay in government. I can't speak for Paul Ryan.
But you just have been. Look, we have had senators who stepped down. We have a number of congressmen who are, some of course, as usual, are just stepping down because they lost safe seats, so they knew they would be defeated. So all of a sudden, they decided it was moral and worthy to spend more time with their children and grandchildren. It's the usual lie everybody comes out
with. No, of course, they're saving face. They don't want to get slaughtered.
No. In Ryan's case, he is shamelessly hungry for power. He always has been. And the fact that absolutely no Tea Partiers have spoken up against him. Well, all these different people like Michelle Bachmann who rose and fell rapidly as Tea Party favorites, right? And the argument was, well, they made fools of themselves because they didn't know about enough about political process. Now we go to the opposite extreme. We go to the opposite. We have a Washington wonk, a policy insider, the arch architect of deadlock on the Republican side of the aisle for the last 4 years. And he is now the great champion of the Tea Partiers, and there is not a single significant Tea Party figure who has spoken out against Ryan or said this makes a joke of it. There is no debate about this in
Martin,
Tea Party circles.
Martin,
there is none. There
Martin,
is none.
Come up for air for a second. Let me make a point.
Oh, I've been up here for quite a while, man, and I find it kind of refreshing. I won't. I'm sick and tired of Republican lies. Lies, but I know about those. But the other side is at least
Martin,
that.
Martin, I am tired of lies coming from both sides, okay?
Yes.
I am tired of President Obama invoking the DREAM Act, saying it's about young children, when in fact the age cutoff is 31. I'm tired of a president who says this will take care of 800,000, and the same day the Pew Hispanic Center, that notoriously undercounts illegal aliens, said, no, not 800,000, 1.4 million. And Doris Meisner, the former immigration commissioner, 2 or 3 weeks later said, no, it's going to be 1.8 million. I've seen estimates go to 4 million. The president said Congress failed to act. That's why he was doing this. Congress did act. It acted responsibly. It voted down bad legislation, the DREAM Act. And I want you to know that there is no integrity to that program. And when Congress asked the president to explain how they were administering the program, he has stonewalled them. I want you to know that there will be no face-to-face interviews. So anybody can claim to be anybody, can claim to be here as long as they want, and no one's going to be able to know otherwise. We know that fraud ran rampantly through the amnesty of 1986. And at a time when you can't get on an airplane, if you're 90 years old, one moment, and you can't get on an airplane without having identity documents that are reliable, supposed to be reliable, to have millions of illegal aliens claim to be anybody they want to be, because most of the terror watch list names are simply names without a biometric that matches it, this is an invitation for a national security catastrophe.
Yes,
at the behest
I agree.
Of this administration. So we're hearing the lies from both sides. Let's be very fair about that.
No, I am.
Absolutely.
That's exactly your point. I agree.
Do I not make sense, Neil?
Absolutely. You know, it's just, well, for instance, if you take, well, you've already pretty much said both sides are responsible. I don't think America can continue to be what we had hoped it would be without some kind of third-party group. Well, the Tea Party got started up. It was a real grassroots happening. But the old Republican Guard stepped in, poured a lot of money into it, got their own people in charge of it, and killed it. You haven't heard anything out of the Tea Party for 2 years.
And then
exactly
what did the
right.
Democrats do? They did the same
way,
thing
Neil.
With the occupiers. They became their proxies.
Yes, of course.
It's pitiful.
But
yeah,
you see,
exactly
here's
right.
the problem.
But
here's
I
the
don't
problem.
See a way out. I wish I did.
But here's the point. First of all, obviously you're a journalist and this was your life's work and I was an agent. It was my life's work, Martin. But, Neil, what kind of work do you do, Neil?
Well, I'm taking care of my dad's fixing to go into the veterans home.
Okay. Well, thank him for his service to our country, by the way.
Okay.
But you know here's my point.
Then you're one of the 47%, my friend. And I'm not saying that's to boost Barack Obama either. The problem is we have this arrogant elitist culture in
the Yes, but here's my point. Martin, here's my point. Let me finish my thought because we're running short on time. We have to go in 11 minutes. Let me just make my point. Most Americans are clueless. Most Americans have become conditioned, and as a journalist, and we've spoken about it, you did a wonderful presentation over at Allen L. Fried Associates where we both spoke, which is how we know each other. It's a Washington-based speakers bureau. Most Americans think in 10-word sound bites. You look at the average evening news, and it's not news. It's garbage. Fishmongers could come up with a better news report. It's about which starlet wasn't wearing panties and who got drunk and disorderly at some party. And if you're lucky, there'll be a three-minute report on something of significance sandwiched in with all the other dreck, all the other garbage. Do either of you guys want to disagree with me on that?
No, I'd love to disagree with you, but I can't.
Neil, would you disagree with me?
No,
Neil,
I won't
do you
disagree,
want to disagree
with you.
With me?
No, I don't want to disagree with you. And I would like to, before the program ends,
sure,
I'd like to thank both of you for some genuine commentary. It's absolutely, I'm walking a little bit taller for getting to participate and listen to the both of you. Thank you so very much.
Well, yeah, I certainly appreciate those kind words. I know you're going to vote on Tuesday.
I would like that very much. You're a great guy. It was an honor being on the same program with you.
Absolutely,
like,
it was.
You know, I take that for granted with you anyway, man.
By the way, if you like the program, make sure you listen next week. You're welcome to call in. Let your friends know about it. Let them also know about my websites. If you have a pen handy, I would suggest you go to that website. You're welcome to contact me through my websites, Neil. It's michaelcutler.net. Talk Border, one word, talkborder.com, and also CAPS Web, C-A-P-S, CAPSWeb.org. That's Californians for Population Stabilization. And I got to tell you, you live in a beautiful part of the country. I've been out to Alabama with the Chamber of Commerce and the Rotary. Not the Chamber of Commerce, rather, the Rotary Club had me out there. And it was a delight to be in Alabama. I've been there twice. It's really a part of the country most people may not think about, but it's really a beautiful place to live, and you're fortunate to be there. But I really very much appreciate you joining the program with us this evening, Neil.
Fight the good fight, man.
And you, my friend. God bless.
Be well.
Bye-bye now.
Yes, bye-bye.
And you, Mike. Bye.
Yes, Neil. I'm sorry. Marty?
Yes, sure, man.
Yeah. I just wanted to thank you so much for joining me this evening. It's always
a
good
pleasure.
And I got to get you on Talk Border again, you know?
By all means. Again, man, it was a pleasure and a privilege.
Thank you for spirited conversation. Your insight is wonderful, and it's always great to join you. We have to have you back soon.
As is yours, there's a verse in the book of Malachi somewhere which very much fits you being on a show like this, especially with you and someone like Neil. The guy in the Bible is talking about, you know, a cynical world where nobody believes anything anymore. And then he says, then those who fear the Lord talked together to each other, one to another, and the Lord remembered them and recorded it in a book.
Huh. That's a beautiful
line.
That's beautiful. Well, and you know, the founding fathers, and when you talk about Jefferson and what, you know, this was the country that was, in their brilliance, in the First Amendment, and so many people don't know this, because if you ask people, what's the First Amendment? They rattle off freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion. You know what they always leave out? The other two, the right to seek redress of grievances. And boy, oh boy, as that late radio talk show host Terry Anderson used to say, if you ain't mad, you ain't paying attention. And the right to peaceably assemble. Peaceable assemblage was important, so much so, it's right in the First Amendment, because they knew that the democratic process required an informed electorate that was willing to go out and have the discussion, the debate, the argument, the agreement, the disagreement. We agreed on most things tonight. We didn't agree on everything. And that's how America works. That's how Congress is supposed to work.
You hit the nail on the head. I'm going to be off now, Mike, but I'll leave you with this, and you know it better than I do. It's not the way America works. It's the way America used to work. It's
yes.
the way America is supposed to work. We pray in our dreams it's the way America will work again, but it's not the way America is working now or has been for quite some time.
Unfortunately, you're right. Martin, thank you so much for joining me, and I'll just talk to the audience for another minute or so, and then we're going to end the show. We're really running late today, but it was just such a great conversation, and I thank you for your insight and your perspectives. And look forward to speaking with you soon and having you back real soon, Martin.
Always a joy, my dear friend. God bless.
Be well. Folks, this is Michael Cutler, as you know. That was Martin Seif. We had a caller, gentleman Neil. America needs to have these conversations, folks. You know, when I was a kid, I was taught by my parents, you don't discuss religion and you don't discuss politics. That's wrong. Religion, absolutely, that's private. There's no reason to have that out in public. But politics, Too many Americans are uninvolved, and that's wherein lies the problem. If you look at the Constitution, if you look at the dream that the founding fathers had, the life that they breathed into this great nation, they understood that Americans were supposed to be in charge of their own government. President Lincoln talked about a government by the people, for the people, of the people. I'm probably getting that sequence backwards or something, but you get the point. The government is supposed to represent us, we the people, not the corporations, not the guys that are worth $15 gazillion, but American citizens who pour their blood's work into what they do. And each job is kind of like a musician playing an instrument in an orchestra, and no one job is necessarily more important than the other. We've come to look down our nose at people that get their hands dirty, get dirt under their fingernails, go home with sweat on their brow. I'm going to end this by, first of all, making sure that I tell you to please, please, please vote. Tuesday's coming. Homer Hickam, the author of the book The Rocket Boys that became that amazing movie, October Sky, grew up in Colwood, coal mining town in West Virginia. You find out that he grew up to become a NASA engineer. It's his life story. It's an autobiography. I recommend that if you have children, get the book The Rocket Boys, get the movie. October Sky. But he delivered the eulogy at the Sago Mine Cave-In about 5 or 6 years ago, and he said something that absolutely brought a tear to my eye. It made me think of my dad and his buddies in the construction trades and all the other hardworking blue-collar Americans who do an honest day's work under tough, dirty, dangerous conditions, and he said that there's no water holier than the sweat off a man's brow. That's the kind of reverence for the people who actually do an honest, hard day's work that has been lacking from this country for far too long. If you're listening to my program today, I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope it's thought-provoking, and I hope I convinced you to get involved in government. It's more important than Dancing with the Stars or worrying who's going to win the Super Bowl or who's going to win some other contest. This isn't a contest, folks. This is the real reality program. The reality of a country whose greatness, I fear, may only be found in its rearview mirror if we don't get back to basics and have Americans take their responsibilities seriously and make certain that they make their politicians accountable. When we go to restaurants, we are very specific about the food that we want to eat and the way that we want it prepared. We need to be no less specific in dealing with our elected representatives, whether it's on the city, state, or federal level. They work for us. It's not the other way around. And we've got to be smart enough to know when we're being lied to. If you ran a business and allowed your employees to run roughshod over you the way we the people have allowed our elected representatives to run roughshod over us, your business would go away. It would become bankrupt. You couldn't stay in business. I fear that is what's happening with America today because we the people have gotten too darn lazy. We need to roll up our sleeves and remember that to the founding fathers, the most important title in our government was that of citizen. You and me, we the people. Thank you so much for joining me this evening. I hope you found this to be a thought-provoking and an enjoyable, as it turns out, 90 minutes today. We've gone long. Please check out those three websites, michaelcutler.net, that's one word, TalkBorder, one word, TalkBorder.com, and to my friends in Southern California or in Santa Barbara, California, my friends over at CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization, their website, CAPSWeb.org. If you can help them out, that would be a good thing. That's the story for today, folks. I wish you all a good weekend. Be well. And remember to vote. And also please remember that democracy is not a spectator sport. We definitely need to be involved in our own government. Nothing could be more important, especially today. Good night, everybody. Again, remember to vote. So long.